Welcome to All Sides with Amy Durovich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we talk with people from around the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Having access to reliable information is everything in an era of misinformation and fake news. And one of the last bastions of reliability are libraries. Libraries and librarians who sustain them are often underappreciated pillars of an information ecosystem. One Columbus librarian, however, did receive the recognition she deserves. Consumer health librarian Missy Creed from Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center recently received the I Love My Librarian Award from the American Library Association, and she joins us now. Missy, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So congratulations on your award. What did you think whenever you found out you won the I Love My Librarian Award?
I was absolutely blown away. I never expected it. No one told me that they were nominating me. The committee that nominated me, some of my fellow librarians and some people that I work with and do the outreach with, they kept it secret. So I was completely blown out of my chair when I received the phone call from the American Library Association.
Well, that's great. And arguably, it's one of the cutest award names I've heard. I love my librarian. That's adorable. So what is the significance to you of receiving an award from the American Library Association?
Oh, I just can't even begin to tell you how honored I am. It's such a privilege to receive it. But really, the award highlights the collaboration that librarians and libraries are in every day and in the community. Librarians do go out behind their desk, and they do go out into the community. And I'm one of those librarians that do. And I feel so privileged to do that.
So I called you a consumer health librarian. I think we're going to have to explain what that means exactly.
Sure. A consumer health librarian is a librarian that specializes in health information. I have a consumer health information specialization from the Medical Library Association. And along with my degree, my master's degree in library science, I received that from the Medical Library Association. And what it entails is me taking special courses in order to find reliable, easy to read, easy to understand health information. And all of those adjectives are very important. You need it to be easy to read, you need it to be easy to understand, and you need it to be reliable as well as updated. You don't want old health information if you've been recently diagnosed with diabetes or high blood pressure. You want the most reliable, updated health information.
So you are at the OSU Wexner Medical Center, and you're helping patients. You're a librarian for patients. Is that correct?
That is correct. I help patients, their families, the doctors, the nurses, anyone that comes in and needs reliable health information in order to better understand their health condition, the health condition of a loved one, or maybe you're a nurse or a physician needing some extra information to talk to the patient for them to better understand their health condition, and then for them to ask questions. Sometimes you get diagnosed with illnesses and you have no idea where to begin. You hear the one word or you hear the diagnosis and your brain kind of leaves you, and you think, how in the world am I going to deal with this?
Well, I don't know that I knew hospitals had librarians. Do all hospitals have librarians?
Not all. They may have links to information. I'm an actual physical person. I have a physical library. It's located in Rhodes Hall in the atrium on the fifth floor by pastoral care. I have a wonderful group of librarians. They sit over in the health sciences library, and they deal with the researchers and the nurses that are going for their advanced degrees and helping them, do research and find impact factors and everything for their research. So I deal with more of the community and the patients.
This is Fascinating Ohio, and we are talking with consumer health librarian Missy Creed. She recently received the I Love My Librarian Award from the American Library Association, and she works at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. Did you always want to be a librarian growing up?
I don't think so. I think I've always wanted to help people find the information or find what the tools that they needed to succeed in life. And I started with Ohio State, I think back in 2008, but I have been in my current position since 2018. And what I love about it is I help people find information to better understand their health condition. And health conditions can be scary. But if you have the knowledge, you can ask better questions and you can have better conversations with your healthcare provider because everybody's health is different.
Do doctors or nurses refer people to you, or do you know where you're needed?
They can. They can refer people. I am right by one of the many surgical areas, patient waiting areas. So their families often come in and say, oh, I have a loved one that's getting this type of surgery, or I have been diagnosed with this or that. And they come and I let them browse through the shelves. Everything is free. Everything is reliable. Everything is easy to read and easy to understand. And I let them do the browsing in case there is a medical topic that they're uncomfortable talking to me about. I let them have that privacy and that confidentiality to explore it. And if they have any questions, they can come up and say, oh, I want to learn more about diabetes, or I want to learn more about my heart condition. Can you help? And I'll be more than happy to help them go on the computer, or I can go on the computer for them and print the information for them. I'm a big advocate of print.
I was wondering, I was going to ask you about books versus helping them on the internet. So you do both. You have books that they can look at, but then you're also helping them print out things from the internet.
I only have a few books. Mm-hmm. Recently, we weeded out all of the books, and I have information that you can take. They're booklets, maybe by the National Institutes of Health, National Institutes of Aging, or maybe the American Diabetes have put on something, or the American Cancer Society has put something on. And I go out and I find those reliable sources and I bring them into the library. And they're free. You don't need to return them. That's one of the things that I've always worried about is people taking something from the library and then thinking that they have to return it or get fined. You don't have to. Everything you can take with you, and don't worry about returning it. It's yours, yours to keep or yours to pass along to your loved one.
I can imagine that you're talking to some people during a very scary time for them. Right? Some people are coming in, they've gotten a diagnosis they weren't expecting, they didn't really know what was wrong with them. Can you tell me a story where you feel like you helped someone?
Sure. Like I alluded to before, people, they get news from doctors and nurses that they weren't expecting, or maybe they were, and it still hit the wrong way. And your brain kind of leaves your mind, and you focus in on that word, and you block out everything else that healthcare professional has told you. So, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I was sitting in the library and a gentleman had come in and he was clearly, clearly upset, in tears. He was probably in his 60s and his loved one was in the hospital and that loved one was dying. Mm-hmm. And he was having a very hard time accepting it. And what I did was I sat and I let him cry and talk about his loved one. And we did some research on some of the words that the doctor was using. And I sent him away with medical definitions of the words he wanted. And he felt much better about the situation once he had a better understanding of the words that were being used.
It sounds like you're a therapist, too, not just a librarian, maybe a little bit.
I think sometimes I am, but I do feel very privileged to hear stories. When I go out into the community and I'm invited to health fairs or church events or I've been to growers markets and sat up and sat my table up and talked to people. And I just feel so honored and so privileged to hear people's health stories about what had happened to them and how they navigated through that system. And if I can help them in any way, that's what I'm there for.
Now, I would think that you're constantly having to update things, right? I mean, I can't think of anything that changes more than medical information. So are you just, are you in contact with doctors and nurses, or is it just you, like, just constantly researching?
I try to figure out what is going to be the most prevalent. And unfortunately, here in Franklin County, though I do serve anybody that contacts me, here in Franklin County, diabetes, high blood pressure, mental health, maternal health care are all very important topics that need to be discussed and people need more information on. Fortunately, here at the Ohio State Wexner Medical Center, we have two excellent patient education departments. And those are healthcare professionals. One's at the Ohio State Wexner Medical Center, and then another patient education department is at the James. And they have healthcare professionals that write these handouts that I give out, the majority of what I have in the library. So they're doing all the research. They're looking at the language that they're using, and they're developing these handouts that are easy to read, easy to understand, reliable, and up to date.
Do you ever give them a little bit of feedback? Like, you know, like, hey, I said easy to read or easy to understand. And this word right here, no one knows what that means.
Fortunately, by the time it gets to me, it has been reviewed by numerous eyes, including not only healthcare, but patient advocacy groups saying, hey, wait a minute, let's try to use another word. I don't quite understand that. So I'm very fortunate in that. And then I do go out to the National Institutes of Health, the National Institutes of Aging, American Diabetes Association, and I look for that credible, reliable health information that's updated. So I do go through a lot of handouts. And if something is outdated, I do need to throw it out.
And you mentioned that you started in your current position in 2018. Is that right?
Yes.
So you had a few years and then you had a pandemic to deal with, right? So I guess that was a lot of different research and a quick research and changing research on the daily.
Yes, but fortunately, I work for the Ohio State Wexner Medical Center, and they are on top of things. And one of the things that I did to start getting into outreach was when the vaccine clinics were coming, the director of the library, who's since retired, she's Linda Hartel, got me involved in outreach, in sitting at a table outside the vaccine clinics, giving away easy to read, easy to understand health information on different health topics. And from there, it kind of blossomed. I was involved in 2019, I was involved in the All of Us project from the National Institutes of Health. And so outreach has kind of grown over the years.
Well, I think that you probably hit on it, but the last thing I was going to ask you was what's your favorite part of your job? But it seems like you love your whole job.
I do love my whole job. I think most importantly is just getting and meeting people, and I feel so privileged to hear their health stories and to see what impacts their life. And health is different from you and I. If you had diabetes and I had diabetes, it could look differently and we could handle that diagnosis differently. So I really feel privileged to listen to people's stories and to help them along their healthcare journey.
Well, I want to say thank you to consumer health librarian Missy Creed. She recently received the I Love My Librarian Award from the American Library Association. Missy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is Fascinating Ohio on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we meet neighbors from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Decades of FBI experience comes with endless amounts of cases and stories. And working in places like Omaha, St. Louis, New York, and Columbus offer lots of unique cases. Joining us is Harry Trombitis, former FBI agent and now podcaster. He shares his years of experience on the podcast, Off the Record, an FBI agent's perspective. Welcome to All Sides, Harry.
Hey, good morning. Thank you, Amy.
Well, let's start with where you got started. You started at Ohio State. You got a degree in criminal justice. Did you always want to be an FBI agent?
No, actually, I didn't. I wanted to maybe be a doctor. And I was a walk-on basketball player at Ohio State, and therefore I wasn't on scholarship. So I needed to get a job. And I found a job with the OSU Police Department and started working there. And the more I talked to the men and women with the department, the more interested in law enforcement I became. So I changed my major from pre-med to criminal justice, and then was in law enforcement at Ohio State, at Evanston, Illinois, outside of Chicago. And then I was a little campus police chief at Creighton University in Omaha. And I kept seeing these guys come into our office, public safety office at Creighton University, looking for parking passes. And they were there recruiting students in the law school. And I struck up a conversation with them. And the next thing you know, they're asking me why I don't become an FBI agent. And by then I had my master's degree in counseling and psychology. And they said, we have a diversified program, and meaning you don't have to be an attorney or an accountant anymore. You can be from any background. And so that's basically how I got my start.
I didn't know FBI agents used to all be attorneys or accountants, so now I know that. So what was that first year as an FBI agent like? It was 1983, you were assigned to Omaha. How was your first year?
Well, first of all, we go to the academy at Quantico, Virginia, on the Marine base there, and that's quite an experience, some training, some of the best in the world. And my first assignment was Omaha. One of my very first cases was a serial murder case. John J. Jubert had murdered three young boys over a period of about a year. And he was an Offutt Air Force Airman. And we were able to identify him and arrest him. And he was charged with the crimes and was convicted and sentenced to death about 10 years later.
We'll go through parts of your career, but let's jump to your podcast right now, because that first year in the FBI grew into decades and decades of experience, and that led you to eventually making this podcast. It's called Off the Record, an FBI Agent's Perspective. What made you want to become a podcaster?
Well, I never really thought about it. I had written a book, a manuscript, actually, that I had to send down at the FBI to get approved, and a 4 to 5 week process supposedly turned into 15 months before I just recently got my approval. But in the meantime, I had known Clark Donnelly from Sunny 95, and we were on the Amber Alert Steering Committee together. And I was telling him about, I just finished my book, and he said, that you worked some great cases over your career. Would you be interested in doing a podcast? And the next thing I know, Clark and Jessica Helmelgarn, also who's technically our producer, but the three of us decided to put together a podcast, mostly based on some of the stories that the cases that I worked over my career, but we throw in some crime prevention, some other kinds of things that I think people would be interested in. So, we try to make it, something for everybody, I guess.
Now, the podcast, you have a full season out right now, so anyone listening can, anywhere you get your podcasts, as they say, it's called Off the Record, an FBI agent's perspective. You can binge listen to the whole thing. Was there a particular case that when you were talking with Clark Donnelly and saying we should make a podcast, which, is there one of your cases that's the most famous?
Wow.
Am I asking you to pick your favorite child by picking your favorite case?
Yeah, well, that would be difficult, as most people know. But, you know, I work so many interesting cases. Again, a couple of serial murder cases, kidnappings, bank robberies. You know, it just, to say that I have a favorite one, I think each case was so unique. And I think it's important for people to remember that I was part of a team. You know, I wasn't a superstar. I was part of a team that worked together in all of my cases to help identify the bad guy, hold him accountable, and bring justice for the victims. And that's pretty much what the podcast is about. And, you know, I try to give some insight into what it was like to actually work the cases, the relationships, not only with the media, but certainly with the family, the victims, you know, what that's like. And it was truly a blessing, depending on your perspective, a horrible thing to be involved in so many different, you know, interesting cases. But, you know, I really appreciate the opportunity that I had.
There's a big, like, you know, there's a lot of true crime podcasts out there. Some people are very obsessed with true crime. You know, it's not just Dateline anymore. There's lots of them. Do you have people constantly asking you, like, oh, tell me a story, tell me a story? Are you obsessed with other true crime podcasts or only your own?
Well, I mean, I watch Dateline and 2020 and 48 Hours and some of those things. I try to shy away from the FBI stuff because it's so inaccurate. And, you know, there's so many misleading things in it. But, you know, I will tell you that probably I've had at least five or six of these cases that have been portrayed on TV crime shows like FBI Files, Discovery Channel, and many others, both in the United States and outside the United States. So I know there's a thirst for true crime. And, you know, again, it's been a variety of the cases. So, you know, getting back to your one question about what was my favorite, I just think each one was kind of interesting and kind of fun to work, you know, horrible situations. But, you know, again, from a perspective of an investigator, it was pretty neat.
For those TV shows you mentioned, were you interviewed? Are you on the TV shows or were they more talking to you for background?
No, I was on all these probably 10 or 12 different shows. Again, I know that there's an interest in these cases because obviously people keep asking to, you know, for me to appear on a show in that. And I just think, true crime is just so hot right now. And it's been that way for a while. And I don't see any slowing down of it. So I'm kind of glad to be a part of it.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides, a show where we talk to Ohioans with an interesting story to tell. With us now is Harry Trumbitis, former FBI agent and now podcaster, who shares his years of experience on the podcast Off the Record, an FBI agent's perspective. So your career involved predominantly working with violent crime. What kind of cases fall under violent crime?
Well, again, you have certainly serial murder, homicide, kidnapping, fugitives, crimes against children. Some of those horrendous cases can be classified under violent crime. Worked organized crime. When I was in New York, worked undercover and followed guys around like John Gotti and some of the other organized crime figures that I think some people would know.
You say that so casually. Oh, you know, I was just undercover following around a mob boss. This.
Well, for 6 years I was assigned at the New York office, and that's predominantly what I did while I was there. And the stories and things, first of all, just working in New York City and all that throughout that area, but then more importantly, the individuals that we were targeting to, try to hold accountable for the terrible things that they had done. It was very rewarding every day to know that you were contributing to the eventual holding of someone accountable for what they, what they did to innocent people, basically.
Now, after you were in New York, you made the move back to Ohio. What led you to come back to Ohio to be an agent?
Well, both my wife and I are from Ohio. We met at Ohio State University. I was from Alliance, Ohio, which is Akron-Canton area. Barb was from Washington Courthouse. We met at Ohio State in the cafeteria at Baker Hall. And so our family was here. We had family, most of our family is in Ohio. So when you're in the FBI, you really don't have any say. Again, this is back in 1983. Now we're talking about they sent you to a small to medium-sized office for your first office, and then a medium-sized office for your second office. Mine was St. Louis, where I worked an undercover car theft case. And then they send you to a big office, which in my case was New York City. And then once you put your time in, you put your name on a list called the Office of Preference List. And Barb and I both wanted to come back to Ohio. And so I put my name on the Cincinnati division. Columbus is part of the Cincinnati division. And, we wanted to get back to the Columbus area. And eventually I got the call that said, "Hey, do you want to transfer to Columbus?" And I said, "You don't have to ask me twice. I'm there."
Was this in
And
the 90s? I don't know what year that was.
yeah, that was, I'm trying to remember, 91.
Okay. So I was looking, at some of the cases that you've covered, and I feel like Columbus had a surprising number of bank robberies back in the 90s. Is that true? Were there a lot, or does it just seem like it?
No, you're absolutely right, Amy. Back in the 90s, we averaged over 100 bank robberies a year, and a couple of times we had five bank robberies in 1 day. They weren't even connected, and
Why?
so we had more bank robberies than actually New York City. We were probably in the top five nationwide for most number of bank robberies. And it's important for people to know that most people don't rob a bank to pay a mortgage. They've got a drug problem, and they know that if they go into a mom and pop convenience store, grandma may pull out a shotgun and start blasting away. So it's much safer to to rob a bank where they haven't at least at this point trained the tellers to start shooting at the bank robbers. So again, had a probably we had a success rate of solving about 85% of our cases. Most of them are serial bank robbers. So if we don't catch them the first or second time, they're back robbing again because again the money runs out and they need drugs. We'll catch them then and be able to clear out a number of the bank robberies. So, it's ironic, Amy, because once I retired in 2012, and once I retired, bank robberies dipped down. I mean, I think they're averaging about 30 or 40 bank robberies a year now, and
It was all you. They were like, that Harry, he's gonna come get us.
I think they realized that there might be competent people working bank robberies now. They better not go out and rob a bank.
You.
If we could get away with it when
Oh
Trumbitis
dear.
was
Yeah,
there.
you had some fun naming some of these bank robbery cases. You gave them fun names. Do you have a favorite couple of names for the cases?
Oh, it was always based on what witnesses told us in the bank. When we interviewed them after the bank robbery, you didn't have to make anything up. I remember, a couple like Bad Breath Bandit. I've interviewed a teller, and she told me all the information about the robbery and gave me a description. I said, "Is there anything else?" And she said, "Oh my God, the robber had the worst breath I've ever smelled in my life." So obviously, I named her the Bad Breath Bandit. We had the Summer Tooth Bandit. He went in, he was missing some of his teeth. So, we said summer there, summer missing. So he became the Summer Tooth Bandit.
Huh, that's clever.
We had the Church Lady Bandit, which actually she had robbed about 10 banks. We had a hard time catching her. The reason why we named her that was because one of the witnesses said, I asked how she was dressed and everything, and in the first bank robbery, the witness said, "I don't know. She looked like she just came from church." So we called her the Church Lady Bandit. So, and again, it just I had fun naming those. I had to be careful because we're making kind of light of a very serious crime. But what we were experiencing, the reason why I named them was because back when we were experiencing so many bank robberies, if we had maybe five bank robberies in a week, and then somebody called in a tip, they'd say, I know who that white guy was that robbed the bank." And we'd say, which guy? Because there were three or four, white guys that robbed the bank that week." And so we started, it occurred to me that if I give them a name, then people can refer to that when they call in their tips. And of course, the media kind of ate it up, and it made it fun for them and interesting. So we got a lot of our cases put, on TV and on the radio and in the paper, and it really helped us solve those cases. So it was actually, again, a pretty good experience.
Now, in your podcast, you mentioned this earlier that you give people some safety tips. One of them that I heard was you were saying that you need to put your phone away and pay attention to your surroundings. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, today, all you have to do is look around. People out in public, their faces are buried in their phones. They're not paying any attention to what's going on. I mean, there's kind of those funny videos that we've seen probably where people walk into a pond or they walk into a pool. They're just not paying any attention to what's going on. And the key to keeping safe is really about paying attention to your surroundings and making sure that your head's on a swivel, that you're looking around for any potential issues or problems that may confront you, and just be alert. I think most bad guys, they look for an easy target. They look for somebody that's not really paying attention, and they're able to move in, act quickly, and then get away. So if you look like you're confident, you know what you're doing, you're paying attention, you're not as an attractive victim as maybe somebody else is.
So, and again, your podcast is called Off the Record. Your first season is out, so people can binge listen. There's about 8 episodes. Are there more to come, or are you going to just do one season?
No, I think we've got enough episodes now based on my the cases and things that we worked over. We worked over the years to do 4 seasons, probably 6 to 8 episodes per season. If people go to YouTube, there's also some shorts, video shorts that Jessica managed to put into the YouTube channel, and they're kind of fun and interesting to look at as well. There may be 20, 30 of those as well. So we're looking to do we've got enough material right now to do 4 seasons, and once that's over, because I still get calls from the media about making comments on things on current situations, we may do a kind of a current affair podcast where we take a look at cases from around the country and Again, just to comment what it would be like if we were working the case, kinds of things to look for, do a lot of things on active shooters, mass shootings, school shootings, and things like that. So, looking to expand.
All right. Well, we will be following along. So, good luck with the rest of your podcast. Good luck with the book. And Harry Trumbitis, former FBI agent and now podcaster, shares his years of experience in Off the Record, an FBI agent's perspective. Thanks again for being here, Harry.
Thank you very much, Amy. Take care.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we introduce you to Ohioans with an interesting story to tell. Starting a farm is difficult and expensive. Yes, despite the odds, Ohio is the home to many successful farms, some of which are just starting out and some have been around for decades. Moso Farm is one that started recently, but has been awarded for its success as well. Joining us now is CJ Morgan, one of the co-founders of Moso Farm. Welcome to All Sides, CJ.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy. Pleasure to be here.
So you won the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association Award called the Beginner Farmer Award. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
So this farm, this award recognizes innovation and commitment to overcoming systemic barriers faced by new farmers. What did you think whenever you found out you received this award?
I was surprised. I didn't really have a lot of prior knowledge that we'd even been nominated. The executive director from OFA gave me a call and I was out doing chores with the animals and thought, what was this phone number calling me? And it was just great, and we're very humbled and honored to be recognized by our farming community.
So it's recognizing you for basically being a first generation farmer. You started this farm with your wife Molly back in 2020. Can you tell us what made you decide to become a farmer, start a farm?
Well, I actually Molly started the farm about 6 months before I met her. She bought a couple calves and started farming. We're both very lucky to have access to some family land to start our farm. Mm-hmm. But I grew up in farm country in Northeast Ohio. Molly's always had a connection to the land here in Athens with her aunt and uncle. And we just loved the farming lifestyle. And we love being a part of the agricultural community and feeding our community and having that connection with the land. And it's just kind of something that we felt like was in our blood and, that we wanted to do. And so we decided to go for it.
Now, you said your farm is in the Athens area. Is that right?
That's correct. We're about 15 minutes outside of Athens proper.
Okay. And where does the name come from? Does it have a significance?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny name. So it was, my wife is Molly Sowash, and it was her childhood nickname because there's another Molly on the street was Moso. And then we met and started farming together, and my last name's Morgan. And so it was kind of this, kind of serendipitous that Morgan Sowash is now Moso Farm. And so we went with that.
Yeah. Well, that's a cute story that connected you together, and her nickname is cute. I like that too. So you, before you started this, you spent some time working in the Forest Service. What did you learn during that time that helped you to, can you apply it to farming?
Yeah, certainly. So, I have a background in wildlife biology and forestry. It's what I went to school for. And then I worked for the Forest Service, both as a field botanist out west in the Rocky Mountains, and here in the Wayne National Forest in Ohio as a silvicultural forester. And so Molly and I are very passionate about silvopasture, which is integrating grazing livestock into trees, into pasture. And so we have about 2,000 trees planted in 17 acres on our farm. And so this is providing shade and feed for our livestock. And I take a lot of my knowledge and background in forestry and apply it here on the farm with our silvopasture plantings.
Yeah, tell me more about that silvopasture method, because when I think of someone with a lot of cattle or, a lot of livestock, you just think of wide open spaces, right? So is this a different way of doing it?
Yeah, definitely. So it has some historical context too within our area of Southeast Ohio that there, pre-European settlement, there were large grazing animals in this area, bison and elk, and the forests were kind of open. There was forage and grasses growing underneath the trees. And so we're trying to kind of recreate and replicate that by planting trees into the pasture, but widely spaced enough that we can still grow grass underneath them. So it's kind of think about like a savanna type ecosystem that you might see, the central plains of Africa, that very much existed in certain parts of Ohio. So that's what we're trying to replicate here.
I'm sure that your livestock don't mind the shade in the summer too. That helps, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's great for animal welfare, and also it's just good for our bottom dollar. The cattle gain weight better. It helps us be more profitable as a beginning farm, and it improves our soil.
You're putting a little more oxygen into the air with all those trees.
Exactly, it's sequestering carbon. Grasslands sequester carbon below ground, and trees sequester carbon above ground in their wood. So we're sequestering carbon two different ways on our farm, while providing habitat, forage, and shade. So it's an all-around win-win.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides, and we're talking with CJ Morgan, one of the co-founders of Boso Farm and the winner of the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association's Beginning Farmer Award. So, what do you produce on your farm? What are your products?
So we produce grass-fed and finished beef. So our beef is fed grass and hay throughout its whole life. And we also do pasture-raised, non-GMO fed pork. So those are our two main products. And we sell at the Athens Farmers Market. We sell to a local farm-to-table restaurant, Little Fish Brewing Company. We have on-farm pickups at our farm here in Athens. And we also partner with a nonprofit urban farm in the Columbus area. For you Columbus listeners, that's Franklinton Farms. And so we come up once a month into Columbus. People can place their orders online at mosofarm.com. And we come up and come to the Columbus area. So
Now, are you just doing beef and pork? You don't have any, do you have any vegetables or anything like that?
we don't. So yeah, we just do beef and pork. And the reason we focus on that is that's kind of where our passion lies in animal agriculture. And also as beginning farmers, it's easy to kind of get burned out. You get a piece of land and you want to farm and you want to do it all. And we've taken the approach of let's be really good at these two things. And let's partner with other farms in a way that we can get products to our customers. So, for example, we partner with a pastured poultry operation, Pasture Fowler, in the Logan area. So, we buy his chicken and sell it to our customers. He buys our beef and pork and sells it to his customers. So that way, we both win. And as far as the vegetables go, we have a partnership with a local vegetable farm. That they have a CSA program, and we provide meat to their CSA program. So our philosophy is, a rising tide lifts all boats. So let's work together.
Now, the award that you won recognizes your efforts overcoming challenges. What sort of challenges in the first 4 or 5 years that you guys have been around, what have you faced?
Really, we've worked on other farms to kind of get our knowledge base, but just knowing the ins and the outs of a lot of this kind of animal agriculture, rotational grazing, animal welfare, health, it can be daunting at first. And we really credit that to a lot of our mentors. We've had a lot of fantastic mentors, both farms we've worked on in our community, older farmers. When Molly started it, I mean, she just cold called farmers that were around here and said, "Hey, can I come see how you load cattle?" And a lot of times it was an older farmer in his 60s, and he said, "Sure, great. Yeah, come on over." And they were just excited to see young people in ag. So, yeah, that's kind of how we overcame some barriers and challenges, was reaching out to the community and to have mentors.
I've talked with other farming associations before, and they've always said that the hardest thing is that a lot of the next generation don't want to inherit farms, so the older farmers don't have anyone to give it to. So I bet seeing a younger farmer probably does make them, it's probably bittersweet, but it makes them happy.
Yeah. Some folks, younger generations, don't want to take on the farm, but there are plenty of folks like us that want to farm. And again, we're very fortunate to have access to family land. But for other farmers that don't, for any beginning farmers listening, reach out and become friends with that older farmer down the road. Work together. Have a good mentor and see if there's some opportunity to start something up there.
Now, you've had to deal with some major challenges. Ohio did have a major drought, and then right now we're dealing with the bird flu. And you're the time you spent, you said you have a background in wildlife biology. What are you thinking about with bird flu right now with your cattle? Because there is, it is spreading. Bird flu can spread to cattle.
Yes, it's not something we're overly concerned with. A lot of the bird flu cases seem to come up in more confined livestock operations, where cattle or animals are a little more stressed. They might have a less robust immune system. In our operation, the cattle spend their entire lives out on pasture. They're not confined. Same with our pigs. So we don't really have a real concern about it. We don't have any large poultry operations in our area. So we keep an eye on the cattle. I know all of them. I want to say personally, I guess they all have personalities. I know them. I know if somebody's off, it looks a little down. So we've been keeping an eye on it. And if anything came up, we talked to our vet. But just the way that we raise our animals, I think, makes them less prone to some diseases.
Tell me what it means to you for people to know where their food comes from. There's a big movement of people trying to understand better and know where their food comes from.
That is where food comes from, or that movement, is the basis of our whole farm and operation. We're direct to consumer. We interface directly with the consumer. We don't sell to a packer or anything. And so, it means a lot to us when people call up and say, "Hey, I'd like to learn more about your farm," or, "How can I buy your products?" And it's also really rewarding for us. I don't think I'd have the same satisfaction that I get from selling, meat directly to a consumer, if we sold it to a packing plant. So, when somebody says, "Hey, that's the best pork chop I've ever had," or "That's the best steak," I mean, that makes it all worth it. I love going to the farmers market every week and being in that community and seeing the same customers and building relationships with them. And so knowing where your food comes from is at its core kind of relationship building, and we really enjoy that.
And we have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you about some events. Do you host some events on your farm too, to kind of bring people in?
Thank you for bringing that up. So we have two free events each year on our farm, that are like free shows that local musicians come. It's potluck style. I usually, like last year, I roasted a pig, and people show up and enjoy music and community. We also have a farm-to-table dinner. My brother is a very accomplished chef, so he curates the menu for that. And then we also do a farm tour as well for families that want to come out and learn about our practices. So all those events are listed on mosofarm.com. So if you want to come check us out, head on over to our website.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you, CJ Morgan, one of the co-founders of Moso Farm and the winner of the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association's Beginning Farmer Award. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Amy. Pleasure to be here.
And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show from all sides in WOSU on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.